Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, Wealth Advisor for Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F in the Ridgeview Corporate Park, and also in the Village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank Building right across from Winkies. And we service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. You can visit ellenbecker.com for more of those details. But my guest today is Phil Remmers. He's an estate planning attorney with Kramer Multoff in Waukesha. And Phil, we've worked together for quite some time. You've worked with Ellenbecker for quite some time as well, but I haven't had a chance to interview on the show before. So I'm very excited for today's talk that we're going to have.
This will be new for both of us, yes.
Well, so let's just dive in and hear a little bit about your background, if you want to introduce yourself to the listeners, about the work that you do.
Sure. I'm Phil Remmers. I'm an attorney in Waukesha. I've worked at Kramer Multoff for the last 30 years. My background is I did start as a CPA with a large national law firm. So I feel like I have a good tax background, good accounting background, numbers background, that sort of thing. But you and I, we spend most of our time. I've been doing it for the last 20 years with Ellenbecker. That's been awesome. And maybe the last, 10 years with you or so. Okay. And we've gone through a lot of clients, talked to a lot of clients, and had a lot of talks on estate planning.
Yeah, so like for the listeners, when we think of estate planning, many times people say, I need to update my will, or I don't want the nursing home to take all my money, or I want to make sure my kids are well taken care of. I'm concerned about who they marry. That's a lot of stuff. We can dive into all of that today, but maybe just at the onset, why do people need an estate plan, and what does that even mean?
Well, a lot of times what it means is, you know, how do we make it easier when something happens to you, when things don't go, you know, well, I guess when life interferes with, you know, how we'd really like it to happen. So that can look a lot of different ways. I mean, you know, sometimes people come to me and, you know, they always talk about wills and they talk about trusts, and we'll talk about that today, and we'll definitely, those are definitely important. But what's also important is, you know, sometimes it's like a lesser known document. You know, we've done a lot of times financial powers of attorney. And mm-hmm. So financial powers of attorneys can be important because even between spouses, you can't always take care of business. I mean, let's say that you're right in the middle of trying to get your house sold and your spouse has an illness. They have a stroke and now they can't sign the documents to sell the house. What do? You're at a standstill. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that without the spouse's signature. That's where a financial power of attorney comes in place. If your spouse has the ability to sign documents for you, then even when you're sick, they can step in and do those documents. Without that, what happens is you need to go through a guardianship proceeding with the court. And to me, it's one of the most inefficient processes. I mean, I get it that the court wants to be, you know, very careful. So what they do is they sign an attorney to the person that they're trying to get a guardianship for. That's called a guardian ad litem. They usually have a social worker, and there might be other people involved. And so it becomes very time-consuming, very expensive. You need to go to, you know, court and show up and have a whole court proceeding. So that's something that we really want to avoid. It's such a simple document. It's not bad if you do that with an estate planning attorney. but there are forms, more limited forms, on the Wisconsin Health and Human Services website too, where you can get that form, and at least you can be able to do those minor things. I mean, just the other day, my wife and I were trying to close a loan, and you know, the days got kind of messed up a little bit, and I couldn't show up on that date to sign the loan, and so I called the bank, and I'm like, hey, you know, if I send my wife with a power of attorney, could you just sign all the loan documents? They're like, sure, just send that over. So that was very convenient. I didn't have to move around my afternoon to, sure, to get the bank closed. So that's just a simple thing. When there's a good comfort level to do that, we can do that. That comes in a lot of different places. I know we've talked about this with, you know, younger children. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say younger children, but when our kids are going off to college and they're 18 years old, a lot of times it's a good idea to get a financial power of attorney in place so that you can maybe move around money for them and their assets, because things change after they turn 18. It's a good idea to have a healthcare power of an attorney in place so that you can make healthcare decisions for them when they get sick. I know I've told you this story, of course, you know, for all of the attorneys, we try to get all of our clients into good documents. Mm-hmm. But of course, we don't do that for our own kids, right? So for my daughter, my oldest, you know, that was easy, right? I had all the documents in place, but my son was, you know, the next year, and so that was kind of old news, so I didn't do it. And then he goes to college, and 3 days later, he gets appendicitis, right? We run out there.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, we can't. He's in surgery right now, but we can't talk to you. I'm like, well, that's awesome. So, So again, it's not a bad idea to get that in place. A popular one these days, and we've been doing a lot more, is that HIPAA document where, again, you give access to, you know, for your kids to give it to you, or for you to give to your children or your spouse so that they can get medical information. So that's really been a big one, that HIPAA. I was kind of reluctant to use it that much for the first 15, 20 years of my practice, because I figured, you know, most parents are not going to want their adult children kind of snooping around.
Sure.
You know, I don't even know if my wife wants me snooping around on or my wife on me, right? Phil's acting a little goofy. Maybe I should go check his medical records. But the more I talk to people, people don't seem to have that much concern with it. They want their children to be able to have access, into their medical records. If something's going on, even if one child is the medical power of attorney, they want the other children to be able to talk to the doctors, or maybe the other child is taking them to the doctor and they need to be able to have conversations with the doctor. So, you know, these documents can just really make life a lot easier. And I guess that was my long, you know, answer to your question. I mean, why do we do estate planning? It's really to make it easier, to make it easier on you, but to make it really easier on your family, because once something's happened, it's not that easy to put that in, especially if you don't have capacity, you're not able to get to the attorney's office and that sort of thing.
Well, and also you are naming the person you actually want to make those decisions or get the information. And I think about that when it comes to, you know, who do you feel is going to fulfill the wishes that you've got, especially on, like, say, the healthcare side?
Yeah, you know, and that really brings up a good point. I guess I don't even give as much thought to that. You know, as a planner, you probably give a lot more thought to that than me, because, you know, I already have the people in front of me. So, of course, we're going to make that, you know, decision. But and that's when people come in front of me. I don't have people that just are not, you know, they don't have it. So you get people that come in and they haven't named these types of things. And then it's like, well, listen, I would want this child to make this decision rather than this child, or I wouldn't want to burden this other child, because they're just uncomfortable making tough decisions and they couldn't make the decision to, you know, withdraw life support and that sort of thing.
Right.
So you want to name someone else. But you don't really want to have children fighting about this either, right? I mean, you know, who do you want to make your healthcare decision? Who do you want to make the financial decision? I mean, what can you imagine a worse time? Everything is going on with a bad health problem. You know, things are stressful already, and now we have two or three kids fighting about, no, mom would want me, no, mom would want me, no,
mom
I'm
would
the
want
favorite.
This, mom would want that,
right?
You know, or dad or whatever. And I've said this to people, you know, I've got two kids, they're still in college, so they're not first and for, you know, front and center on these documents quite yet, but I am pretty sure I know which one's going to be in charge of finances and which one's going to be in charge of healthcare, just for that reason of who's going to be able to steward it the best and really make those tough decisions that I would want made.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why, again, it's just a great idea to, you know, get all those documents kind of in place, get them done early. You know, I have people come in, you know, sometimes they're younger, right? I mean, maybe they're in their 30s and 40s, or maybe they're even in their 50s and 60s, and they're like, well, we really don't feel like we need this yet. I'm like, yeah, I totally get it that you don't need it yet, but that's kind of the point, right?
Good point.
You want to have it in place before you need it, or I would say well before you need it, because you want to make sure that it's in there, you know, that they're ready to go, that you have the people name that you
right.
want then.
In case something happens, mm-hmm. and like you mentioned, when for married people to just get that all set up, because of there's sometimes it's a convenience thing, right? Closing out a loan when your day is busy, you can do it for your spouse. It's really setting who is going to make those decisions. And even for people who aren't married, right? And they have other family members who may want to step in, but you need to name who it is you want to do it. We talked about naming kids, but this is also for those, you know, for the 30-somethings, the 20-somethings that, you know, maybe they have a partner, they gotta name that person.
Right. But those things change over time too. I mean, one of the things, and I think you've kind of seen this, you know, a little bit more, is as people get older, you know, we used to always make them what we call springing powers of attorneys, where it doesn't really spring into life until the person's been deemed to be incapacitated.
Right.
But over the years, we found that's a lot more difficult than you think. I mean,
right.
you have a parent that has a little bit of dementia. They need assistance mm-hmm. with their financing or going to the bank, but they don't really want to be drugged to a doctor, get declared incapacitated, just so that, you know, their kids can, you know, start to do this.
Right.
So a lot of times what we'll do is when there's a trust, these are very dangerous documents, right? So when there's absolute trust in the child, a lot of times what we want to do is really think ahead of time. I mean, maybe we name that, you know, I wouldn't just name my wife as my power of attorney. Maybe I'd name my wife and my daughter now as my daughter gets older and I have total trust in her.
Mm-hmm.
That way, if mom's having a little incapacity, if I'm having a little incapacity, she's not having to take both of us to the doctor, get us declared incapacitated just so she can do it. She can say, you know, don't worry about it, mom. Don't worry about it, dad. I'll go to the bank. I'll take care of this. I'll go to Heather Deaton, right?
Right.
And I'll talk to her and we'll get this taken care of, or Social Security or that sort of thing.
Sure.
And that's the point of it. How can we make this easier? Okay.
Exactly.
We need to worry about protection. These are dangerous documents.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on the trust level, we can put different levels of flexibility in to make it easier. And that's really what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, that's a really important and powerful stuff we're talking about. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk through a little bit more of that and about how people maybe think they can get around having to have a power of attorney and some of the risks involved in alternatives. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, wealth advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. And my guest today is Phil Remmers, an estate planning attorney with Kramer Multoff. So Phil, you talked us through different documents to put in place to give people the ability to make decisions for you while you're alive, but you can't make those for finance and for health, giving them access to information like the HIPAA document for health. There's some other ways that people think they can get around that. And I just wanted to get ahead of that a bit in this conversation. When it's say, oh, I'm just going to add my daughter as a co-owner on my account, or I'm going to give them the password and login to log into the accounts. Give us some thoughts on those alternatives and what kind of the pitfalls and maybe even the benefits around that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people like to put their children on their accounts, but I do think you have to be judicious about it. I think attorneys overall are probably not big fans about it, because you can have different results than mm-hmm. you really kind of expect when those types of things happen. So, you know, the most common one would be maybe to put your children on a bank account, okay?
Right.
And maybe that works okay if it's a small bank account. You know, but the problem is, you know, first of all, you have to worry about that, you know, it's now their money.
Sure.
Okay. So that if they have a lawsuit, if they're getting sued, you know, that sort of thing, can those creditors get to that money? If there's in a divorce, do they have to claim that as part of the divorce?
Mm-hmm.
And it can get pulled all into that. So, you know, there's some risk by putting them on. The other risk can be is legally, when one of the joint owners dies, it becomes the other person's money. So if we're talking large account, well, hey, I got $150,000 in this bank account. It's really always a little bit of an awkward situation for me. Is it's like, oh, well, you're on your mom's account for $150,000. What did she want? Now, some people might say, oh, well, I'm supposed to use it to pay the expenses, and then I'll divide it with my, you know, my siblings. Other people say, oh no, my mom wanted me to have that account.
Right.
And again, I have no, I don't know. I don't know what they wanted. What I do know is that the law says it's their money right now.
Okay. Right.
Now, the other thing we can do is if it's a large account, it can be, we can run into some gift and estate tax issues. Let's say it is a $300,000 or $400,000 mm-hmm. account. Let's say it's a brokerage account and it's a joint account. Then what they do is they kind of, you know, run into, if they gift it to one of their siblings, because it's now their, legally their
right.
money, you know, did we make a gift for $150,000? I might argue that no, it was a constructive trust. It was really their money. But that's not really not necessarily what the law says. I mean, it was their money. You know, they transferred it on. So, you know, that can be an issue too. You know, the other thing that we have with, you know, just putting on the account is it's not as encompassing as we think, right? I mean, you put them on the account, it's like, oh, great, they can, you know, pay the bills and...
Right, they can get access, they have the information.
Right, but does that give them the access to, you know, talk to Heather Deaton and to make, you know, issues with the financial accounts? Okay, it's on the bank account.
Right.
But now we still have, you know, an incapacity situation, and they need to be able to talk to Ellen Becker or their financial advisor or whatever, and they can't do it. Okay, so it's just not all encompassing. The example I like to use a lot is like Social Security office. I mean, you know, it doesn't take much where somebody doesn't want to go and talk to the Social Security office, right? It's
right.
confusing. There's paperwork.
Right.
You're having to jump through a lot of hoops. It's a lot easier to send your child, right? To go
mm-hmm.
ahead and do that. So they want to be able to do that. Well, just having them on the account, that's not going to be enough. That's not going to do it. So these financial power of attorneys are just so much more encompassing, right? That they're able to do whatever you were able to do. And that's really, you know, generally what you want, okay?
Right.
Again, when you have a financial power of attorney, you also have a fiduciary duty. So your children, your agent, it needs to act in your best interest. Under the law, they need to act in your best interest. That's not the same way on a joint account, you know what? And again, if you're very open with these joint account, it's not just a $10,000 checking account, but it's a $500,000 brokerage account, or it's another account, we can have unintended results that it's going to other people. Or, you know, it could be even be that people die in quick succession where, you know, the mom dies, then the daughter dies a few days later, a couple weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have time to get it to
right.
the other brothers and sisters. Well, now the daughter's children are like, well, this is what we inherited. I mean, I don't think we're in a position to start giving this away. That's what the law says, okay? So again, from an attorney's perspective, we want definitiveness. So we want it kind of written down, here's how it works, put in the right documents and kind of utilize it that way.
And I think that you brought up a good point, the fiduciary duty. You know, like we operate in a fiduciary capacity, holding our clients' best interests ahead of our own at all times, and we're, you know, regulated that way. If you have someone on your account and they don't have that same standard, albeit they probably have the best intentions, there can be outside people, right, other siblings that maybe would question what they're doing and really have no basis to question it, right? Because there's not, if you're just a co-owner, there's not the fiduciary duty. Any of the other unnamed other children, if they had any kind of beef,
right?
Because they'd have no standing.
They're like, well, mom wanted you to give this to us. And they get to say, well, no, and I'm not going to give you an
accounting,
and I'm not going to tell you
exactly.
Whatever. It's my assets. You know, I can do what, you know, I want with them.
Right. And not to sound like jaded, like this doesn't happen that often, but it can happen. You know, things change, relationships change. So that's just always, you know, one of the pieces. You know, when you think about estate planning and protection and pieces like that, you know, what other subjects would you want the listeners to hear about?
Well, when we're talking about kind of planning ahead, and that's kind of where, you know, we've gone with this here is, you know, how do we plan ahead? How do we get the right, you know, healthcare power of attorney, financial power of attorney, and HIPAA documents in place? But a lot of people say, well, how do I plan ahead? I don't want to have to go through a court procedure, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I die, I don't want to have to go through you know, probate. So what can I do to accomplish that? There's a lot of ways to avoid probate, but there's pluses and minuses to all of them. Now, you know, the one that, you know, we're most comfortable with, at least I'm most comfortable with, probably as an attorney, right, is to avoid probate is to using a revocable trust.
Okay.
Okay. Now, to me, a revocable trust is a simple document. It's not a complex document. It really is the same as a will. It's just a document that says, when I die, here's how I want my assets to be distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and so my feeling is if we're going to put together documents, why are we going to put together a document that's going to have to go through a court procedure when we could just as easily go through a document that wouldn't have to go through a court procedure? And so that's why we like to use a revocable trust. And we can come back to that in a little bit, but I wouldn't mind exploring a little bit, you know, what are other ways of avoiding, you know, probate? Because that's not the only way. And other people come to me and they say, well, are there other ways to avoid probate? One of them is, we just got done talking about it, right, is joint accounts. I mean, if you put someone on a joint account, you know, that can be an easy way. So sometimes we don't like as an attorney because we get unintended results. You know, it'll get lost in, you know, for creditors. It won't go down to the kids we want. But maybe someone says, well, I only have a one child, and so I would want that child to have it. I'm comfortable that they won't have a divorce or a lawsuit, you know, where it could be taken. And so it can work in that instance. Again, as an attorney, I'm always looking at, you know, the negative side, you know, what could go wrong. And, you know, even if they died, well, it went down to their children. What happens if their children are minor children, right? So now we're having to go through a guardianship.
Right.
So, right, mom dies, it goes to the, you know, the daughter, or, you know, that they both die, you know, together or something like that. Where does it go? Does it go down to the grandchildren? Have we got anything named? Now are we going to have to go through probate because we had two deaths that were kind of close in time and we didn't get it changed and those sorts of things. So, and again, along with all the creditor issues, you know, along with that as well. Another way of doing it, and people are kind of high on this one. A lot of times they come to me and they're like, well, can't we just name beneficiary designations on all of that? And it's crazy, right? Because beneficiary designations are so easy, right?
So easy, and easy to change along the way too.
Yep. And, you know, they say, well, listen, if I just name my kids to get it, it'll just go right to them. And it, in most circumstances where it works good.
Right.
So what I always bring up is, well, it's when circumstances don't work quite as good. Some of those circumstances are you give it to your four children and then there's no money. There's not what I like to call centralized management, right? There's no executor that's taking charge and paying things, right? So who pays the funeral? Well, all four kids should have to pay, you know, put in and pay for the funeral. Well, what happens when one or two children are like, you know what, I'm not paying for that funeral, or I'm not paying that much for that funeral, or those sorts.
Because the money goes to all the beneficiaries
directly,
pretty much right away.
Right.
So any final expenses, if there's, obviously there's probably very often it's amicable, they understand, they have to either pitch money back in, but...
But that's what I'm saying.
Maybe there's the buts where there's not, where it doesn't work out that way.
Right. It works great 60, 70, 80% of the time. But when it doesn't work, then it's a really hassle, right? All the kids are fighting about whether they have to put money back in to pay for the funeral. One of them won't. One of them wants to do the funeral this way. The other one wants to do it that way. You know, are you not better off just naming who you want? That person's got centralized management. Where that also comes in is they'll do that with the accounts. They'll put beneficiary designations on. But then what happens to the house, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the house, but now we got no money. If we need to, you know, do a little painting, we need to fix up the house. Where does the money come from?
To prep it to sell.
To get it prepped to sell.
Yeah.
We don't have centralized, you know, management for that. So that's not a bad lead into, you know, where else can we have beneficiary designations? It's really easy to do it on accounts. It works good, you know. But what happens when you get to a house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get to a house, and you put a beneficiary designation on that, and you can do that these days. It's called a transfer on death deed.
Okay.
But we run into the same issues. Now all of a sudden, it goes down to the four kids. We don't have money in. Some people want to put money in to fix up the house. Other people don't want to put in money to fix up the house. Some of the kids want to sell the house. The other people don't want to sell the house. The other people, oh, I want to live in it. Well, that's fine, but the rest of the three of us own it. Well, that's fine. I'll just live in it for free. And like, well, right. No, we want our money out of it, okay? Or one of them's just, sometimes you get locked up where they're just sentimental, right? You know, you get one child and they're like, oh my gosh, I grew up in this house. It's mom's house. Mm-hmm. I'm just never going to agree to sell. And it kind of sits there. You got to mow it. You got to, you know, maintain it. You got to
pay
do the
property
snow,
taxes.
Snow plow. And the other kids are like, well, what do we do? And I'm like, well, I guess you could sue your sister and do what they call a partition action. And then a court will order the house to be sold. And so that can be done, you know, that way as well. So that becomes kind of an issue along that way. So that's why, again, I'm not always that comfortable with doing a transfer on death deed as well. When you have a transfer on death deed, you don't have centralized management. Other people can have other issues. You can have one of the kids could die on that, and now it goes down to their children. And so now you have three brothers and sisters, but you have three nieces and nephews.
Right.
You know, as well. So
it can get complicated. It starts out maybe less complicated, but there are things that could happen along the way that make it more complex. And the goal or an intended outcome is to make things easier. When we think about estate planning, beneficiary designations are part of estate planning for sure. But I think there's what we'll talk about when we come back from this next break is, you know, additional ways to cover what you want to have happen, not just doing beneficiary designations.
For sure.
With that, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, wealth advisor, and my guest today is Phil Remmers, an estate planning attorney with Cramer Moltoff. So Phil, we've talked quite a bit about how to make things easier, how to avoid some of the different pitfalls of when something happens, when our life ends, when something makes it where we can't make decisions. We were just talking about probate being costly and long. Do you want to dive into some more of that? We didn't spend a lot of time talking about why is it so bad?
Yeah. These days, you know, it's not as bad as it used to be. It has been streamlined. But really what it comes down to is, why do you want to add more complexity to the estate administration process? If we can take the court system out of it, we're going to make it less paperwork. We're going to make it less costs. We're going to make it less attorneys.
Okay.
So all that's a good thing. So for those reasons alone, we would want to do it. But other things can kind of come into play with it. It can also be a privacy issue.
Right.
So, you know, court records are generally public information. So could outsiders get it? Could, you know, somebody in a divorce of one of your children, could they be able to get that information? Could you know, somebody in the public get that information if the person's a public persona? I mean, we've had this, and I thought it was maybe even with Prince and Whitney Houston.
Right.
Where I can't remember if they didn't have a will or they didn't have anything at all, but it had to go through probate. And so everybody can say, okay, who, you know, here, this kid's getting this and this is what's happening here and here's what they're fighting about and that sort of thing. And so we want that out of there as well. Mm-hmm. A really nice thing with probate is it also avoids having to give all the natural heirs notice. So usually what you have to do is when you go to a court system, anybody that would get money if there was no will in place has to be noticed up.
Okay.
So let's just say that you don't have children and you want to give it to your brothers and sisters, but you only wanted to give it to some brothers and sisters or only to some nieces or nephews, or you know, you only wanted to give it to some of your children and not all of your children. Well, it's a little bit awkward when everybody else has got to be noticed up even though they're cut out, right? It gives them the ability to challenge it, you know, easier. They know what's going on. They can hold up the proceeding. That can, you know, add more time and that sort of thing. So part of it is it just kind of streamlines the process. And so, you know, if you're only going to give it to two nieces or nephews or only give it to two of your three kids, those two just get it. Nobody else knows about it. The money's, you know, distributed and the other ones don't have a chance to complain. There's not a court proceeding going on that they've basically been invited to.
Right. Right.
To complain about it. Hey, do you have anything to contest that you want to complain about? Sometimes they're like, well, hey, I got this invitation. I got this notice from the court. Maybe I'll just show up and lodge my complaint. It's probably not going to be a winner, but again, it just takes more time. It takes more attorney fees and that sort of thing, and that's what we want to try to avoid.
And I think that privacy thing, like you said, with respect to just inside the family and family dynamics, that's very important. And I think about outside influences that could see those records. And again, like you mentioned, the big cases like, you know, Whitney Houston, Prince, and see what people got and who they are and what they got. But I'm even thinking for a more typical scenario, especially if you've got maybe you've got a child who can be manipulated, right? Or can make really impulsive decisions on business ventures and investments. And they've got a group of people that they hang around with who can then see what they received if it goes through probate. Hey, I just saw that, you know, I know you've got some capital from this inheritance. How about you go in on this business with me? That's a risk right there.
Yeah, and it's definitely what we're trying to avoid. Again, by keeping it public, it keeps it private from everyone. So, you know, whether that's other family members,
right,
whether there's friends, and who's going into it like that.
For sure.
One of the other things that you know, kind of comes to mind is, you know, a lot of people don't want to use trust sometimes because they're like, well, I heard you have to fund the trust. You have to change all of your assets into the trust. But I think this kind of goes into the way that we do most of our trust funding is we actually use beneficiary designation. So we've kind of talked about the downsides of beneficiary designations, that you can get kind of unretended. You know, you don't get centralized management. If someone dies, you know, it won't go to go to their children and it may be unfunded. But one of the issues there is it's easy to use these beneficiary fund designations to fund our trusts. So back in the day, a lot of times what we would do is we'd put your house into the trust so that it was there when you die, so it wouldn't have to go through probate. Now we've got other ways of doing that. We've got transfer on death type of possibilities, so we can have the house transferred into the trust without putting it in the trust while you're alive. Same thing with the vehicle. So we're not sending people down to the courthouse. We're not having them issues with their bank or their insurance company. We're not sending them to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Right.
Even back in the day, we would have them change all their bank accounts into the trust. That's a bigger issue today. And the reason for that is most people have a lot of automatic withdrawals in their deposits attached to the bank account. So if we can skip that, if we can use a beneficiary designation, you keep your bank account in your name exactly like it is now. You just put a beneficiary designation on it that it transfers into the trust without probate when you die. That becomes a lot easier than making this ownership change while you're alive then.
Right, exactly. Because anything that can remove the hassle, right, is going to be more easily accepted and brought in, right? If you can remove the hassle of having to change all your accounts, that's a barrier to getting a trust that's gone then.
Right.
You know, I think sometimes we think of a trust, and maybe it depends on kind of what era you're a part of, but, you know, trust fund babies, right? Like, am I going to have this, like, is a trust really only for rich people, for the extremely wealthy, for like what should have been Whitney Houston and what should have been Prince.
Right.
But I think you can debunk that as well, that it's not only for the extremely wealthy.
Really, really, I think it's for everyone. And I know that sounds a little bit self-serving, you know, coming from an attorney, but the reason I feel it's for everyone is if you're going to have to go through probate and you don't want to have like a simple beneficiary designation on, because again, there's not centralized management because of these other types of things. That's why we want it to happen like that. There's lots of benefits, you know, to the trust as well. What we've talked about a lot is asset protection trusts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, we can have the trust do a lot of different things instead of, even if you've only got a couple $100,000 and you're like, well, I don't have enough for a trust. Yeah, but we can avoid probate.
Right.
We can get the assets where we want them to go. We can get centralized management. But one of the other things would be is, well, if I die, and maybe I've only got $400,000 to leave to my child, but I'm going to leave $400,000 to my child. If it's by beneficiary designation, they have that in their own name. mm-hmm. right? And so if they get a divorce, it could be under the attack. If they die, it goes to maybe their spouse, because that's what their will says, right?
Yeah.
It goes to their spouse rather than their children, and maybe that's where they want it to go. Okay, and there's certainly no protection from car accidents, lawsuits, bankruptcies, death taxes, mm-hmm. you know, all those sorts of things. So, you know, the way we, you know, we've done this for years, right, Heather, together,
yeah.
Is to set up a kind of a trust within a trust. So, you know, our base trust, our revocable trust, is really just a simple will. It just says, when I die, here's how I want my assets to be distributed, do it without probate, centralized management, all that. But when my kids, when my nieces and nephews, when my beneficiaries inherit money, I want it to be in a protected trust for them. And so this is kind of getting what you know, are we creating trust fund babies? But I don't think we're creating any more of a trust fund baby if we just gave them outright that money, whether that's $400,000, whether it's $4 million, it's $40
right.
million dollars, they're going to be in control of that money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so they're going to be a trust fund baby anyway. Within a trust, we can get protection from divorce, car accidents, lawsuits, bankruptcy, all those sorts of things. But it's also, once we have that set up, it's easy to put other planning around it. So do we say that instead of giving all the money when they're 25, that they don't get the money till they're 30 or mm-hmm. 35? Or do they get 10% when they're 25 and they get another 50% when they're 30 and 35? We can do those sorts of things.
Yeah, kind of put that protection against protection from themselves, right? And like maybe poor decision making.
It can be poor decision making, or maybe you just want to motivate your child that you don't want them to say
right.
like, well, listen, I'm 30. I got $1 million. I don't need to like work hard. I don't need to build a career. I'm good. Maybe if you push that off to 35 or 40, they can do that. I'm not saying that's for everyone. That's kind of a personal decision, but that you can do that. But this also can come in, you know, we've done a lot of supplemental needs trusts, right?
Right.
So if you have a child with a disability, it's very easy to just build, you know, tuck that trust, that supplemental needs trust within your trust. And now we've got protection so that benefits are not lost if they inherit the money. It's protected for them. Or if we have somebody that has a dependency issue, that we can say they can only get certain money or they can only get it certain times. Maybe they can have their rent paid for them. Maybe they can have their groceries paid for them, but we're not just going to give them money. We're not looking to micromanage that.
Right.
But it does give us the ability to do that in certain circumstances. We need that. And so that gives us the ability to do that.
Yeah, and that's all really powerful stuff, powerful planning options that we have. So after this break, we'll come back and talk a bit more. I'd love to hear insights on when you're naming someone to be in charge of other people's money, like what to consider. So with that, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, Wealth Advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. And my guest today is attorney Phil Remmers, estate planning attorney with Kramer Multoff. So Phil, before the break, we were talking about how to assign or the fact that you have to assign a trustee, an executor, some different roles and responsibilities. So do you want to share just what kinds of expectations you should have or qualities you should look for in the trustee and even the trustee of the subtrust when we want to help with decision making down the road?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's a lot of qualities that go into it, but I don't think it has to be as difficult as people think. We get questions all the time. I mean, should we be naming a corporate trustee? And I don't think that's always necessary. Sometimes it's the right circumstance, and we'll talk about that. But a lot of times it can be a family member. It can be one of your children or your couple children together, or a niece or nephew, brother or sister. They may need a little bit of guidance from a financial advisor, from an accountant or an attorney, but most of the time they can do it, you know, themselves. Some of the qualities that I think really are important is definitely honesty, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need them to be, you know, honest with the money, that they don't borrow it to themselves, use it for themselves, that sort of thing, and that they're following along what the rules of the estate plan of what the trusts say. We don't want them to say, well, I'm going to do a different division, or if, you know, I'm having a falling out with one of my brothers and sisters, and so I'm just going to redivide the assets, or if they're going to take what they would call, you know, self-serving. They're like, well, I'm going to sell this to myself at a lower...
At a big discount.
At a big discount, right. Okay. They actually can't even sell it at fair market value to themselves. I mean, that's, you know, self-dealing, you know, mm-hmm. issues there. So honesty is obviously a huge one. Another one is that they have common sense. I think that always kind of goes, that they kind of make, you know, good decision-making and that sort of thing. And then the third being is that they need to have the energy to get it done. So
right.
sometimes, a lot of times, like the biggest issue that we really run into is people that just don't get it done. They're kind of like, oh, you know, this is such a burden, or, you know what, I just so sad that, you know, something happened to mom or dad that I'm just not going to do anything for 6 months, for 2 years, for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And then people get upset, right? I mean, you got a house sitting there for a couple of years. People haven't gotten their money for a couple of years. I mean, they a lot of times they want to be gracious, but graciousness goes away after 6, 9 months, you know, maybe a year. So they need to have some, you know, urgency to get it done, because that's where we see, you know, where you run into a lot of problems.
And I think, you know, one part that you mentioned was working with a team, right? To give that person who's going to be responsible for this, you know, in that moment, give them a checklist, a process, right? Because they're not going to know all the answers, yeah. nor would you expect someone to have all the answers.
Yeah, a little bit of guidance, you know, goes a long, long way. And this is why we really don't feel like they need to be an expert. People say like, well, my kid's not an expert on, you know, financial issues and that sort of thing. Yeah, but even somebody that's a good financial peer person is not necessarily going to know what to do with an estate. So, you know, what we like to do is, you know, go see an attorney, go see an accountant. It doesn't mean that they're going to spend a ton of time, but what they can do is they can kind of, the way we do it is we go asset by asset. So, mm-hmm. okay, we have this house. Does somebody want it? Do you want to get it sold? Where do you want it to go? Okay, based on what you want, you know, based on your purposes, here's, you know, what you should do. And now they've got a checklist. They have something to move forward on. Then we move to the next asset. Okay, do you want to keep all the stocks and bonds? Do you want to liquidate it to cash? You know, what do you want to do? We get done. It doesn't take long. Sometimes we get done with an hour meeting. And now they have a guideline. So,
right.
you know, that, you know, they know what they're doing. They feel good about it. And they're like, wow, this is one of the easiest things I've ever done. We have other people come to us, and they don't come see us or another attorney or accountant right away. And they spend for 3 months, and then they come to see us, and then we tell them what to do, and they're like, oh my goodness, it's that easy. And I'm
right.
like, yeah, I don't know why, but it's something that if you just don't know what to do, it's really hard. But once somebody tells you what to do in simple, easy steps, it's pretty simple.
Well, and to making sure that you're doing it the most efficient way, the right way, possibly even in the right order, right? So you could imagine, and you've seen this, I'm sure, in those first 3 months when they're kind of on their own, you know, maybe, who knows, they're hearing, you know, advice from colleagues or neighbors or the internet on right. what to do next.
And the right order can make a big difference,
yeah.
right? Because people go to the bank and they'll be like, well, the bank wants this and this and this. Well, if we already knew that, now you already have the EIN number. You already
sure.
have this documentation.
Yep.
You already have this in place. And they give it to, they go to the bank, and now it's done. Now it's like, well, they go to the bank. Now they need this. Now they talk to some people. Now they go see the attorney. Everything's backwards, and they've kind of, it's taken double, triple the amount of time.
Right, right. Well, this has been really helpful. You know, I love this kind of information that we can share with people, give them a view of maybe their own situation, things that they have in place they feel really confident with, maybe things that they're questioning whether or not they need it, should they redo it, and just understanding that there's lots of different features to put into estate planning that can help you feel good about what's going to happen when something happens. So, Phil, if people wanted to contact you or get in touch with your office, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, they can just go on our website at Kramer Malthoff or give us a call at 262-542-4278.
Awesome. Thanks again so much, Phil. And for the listeners, remember that Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and on Sundays from 12 to 1 p.m. And if you like today's show and you want to learn more about Ellen Becker Investment Group and see some of our great upcoming events, you can visit ellenbecker.com or call us at the main office at 262-691-3200. As always, I hope that we've made a difference in your personal and your financial well-being. And remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen.